Welcome to Chronic Combat Conversations, a live look at our best bets, picks, and predictions for every UFC card. With your hosts, TB Scouting MMA and
The Guru, back once again for UFC Vegas 43, also known as UFC on ESPN Plus 56 or UFC Fight Night 198. Caitlin Vieira versus Misha Cupcake Tate in the bantamweight division. Definitely an interesting main event that we have here. The rest of the card itself is actually pretty darn exciting. You got Michael the Maverick Chiesa returning after his disappointing performance against Vicente Luque against undefeated top prospect Sean Brady. Man, that fight is, I almost kind of, not to be disrespectful to the ladies, but I do kind of wish that that was the five rounder we were getting.
I definitely agree with that. But as far as importance in the division, I could definitely see why they made Vieira versus Tate the main event. So, I totally respect it. And you know what, if one of them might end up getting a title shot soon, you'd love to see them get the five round experience. So I can't hate on it too much, but as far as the fights I'm most excited for, I mean, listen, Michael Chiesa versus Sean Brady, if that doesn't get you going, man, we got to get you checked out by the doctor, you know? Like, that should get the blood pumping for sure.
And fan favorite Terrence McKinney makes his return against a Firas Ziem, who's, right, the smile killer. What an apropos name for him. He's crushed a lot of smiles by decision, betting tickets, and his former opponents. So Terrence says to tune in to his fight, so I'm definitely excited to see that.
Hell yeah, you know I'll be there for it. So well, at least not in person, but listen, I think, you know, I'm very excited to get down and you know, really get down into this card. And we start off here with Luana Pinheiro versus Sam Hughes. I actually did not get to the stats for this fight, but I am very excited to see how we get it matched up here, because Luana Pinheiro comes in, she's actually giving up 3 inches of height and 2 inches of reach, but she makes up for that with some power and explosion. She is going to be 2 years younger, but she has that one win in the UFC so far by Random Marcos getting DQ'd with an illegal upkick.
She deserved an Emmy for that one, man. And I didn't really understand it, because she was really winning the fight. And man, I watched that upkick live. I rewatched it again this week. I probably rewatched it for Random Marcos a couple weeks ago. Listen, it hit her. I'm sure it didn't feel good. But that was some soccer acting if I've ever seen it. I think she was gassing out. Because if memory serves me right, that was towards the end of that first round. And if we look at Luana Pinheiro, if you look at her record here, the only time she's been outside the first round was in 2017, which was a split decision loss. So really, really tough for us to play her at over minus 400 here when, Sam Hughes has looked like, you know, respectfully, like a bit of a punching bag so far in the UFC. But if she's able to survive, if the Homer Simpson effect is there, if she can survive some punishment, is it possible that Pinheiro punches herself out here?
I could totally see that happening. Sam Hughes, while she's ineffective completing her takedowns, she's effective in getting the fights in the clinch and against the cage. However, I could see that being a detriment when it comes to the throws and the judo ability that you're getting out of Pinheiro. And then she also has the jiu-jitsu background. So it's not like, you know, she doesn't know what she's doing down there. She has 5 submission wins in her career. She's a national judo champ, judo black belt, jiu-jitsu purple belt. She was also, you know, a national wrestling silver medalist. So really it does just come down to the gas tank questions and can she get a first round finish? Because the second this fight gets into the second round, that's where, if I'm in a live betting scenario, I'm throwing down money on Sam Hughes. But realistically, we'll see what happens. If I was going to bet anything on this fight before it started, I think that realistically, you know, I wouldn't think it would be that crazy to see this fight end in the first round. Or, I mean, if you get that 60-second, you know, finish, I mean, Pinheiro could totally just overwhelm Sam Hughes plus 900 in the first minute. I mean, that's crazy. But realistically, if you just wanted to say, you know, Pinheiro inside the distance or Pinheiro first round, those would be really kind of what I'm looking for. Pinheiro in round one is plus 215.
So really, really crazy. I was almost thinking that this might be one of those spots that I was wondering what we'd get for a line, wondering if maybe that's the spot we want to fade the narrative. But they have the line juiced written like it's a – I feel like it's a, like a quote-unquote normal women's fight. They have the under 2.5 at plus 100 and over 2.5 at minus 130. So, I mean, is it not – and I mean, 2.5 rounds, is, like, it's – we'll like you're, we figure that we're going to know by the end of round one whether it's going to go the distance or not. Like, if we go to the round two – unless she's, again, like really, unless she smashes her in those first opening minute and 30 seconds of round two as well, I think that's going the distance.
I completely agree. I can't find myself pulling the trigger on, you know, picking Sam Hughes to win outright. I do think that maybe the line value has gotten out of hand if you were looking for like parlay pieces, but that doesn't mean that I really side with Sam Hughes technically. I think her being the bigger fighter and possibly being able to wear throughout some of the damage in the first round, she has shown, you know, to be able to work past, you know, the first round with Loma. But, you know, when she faced Tisha Torres and faced the onslaught, there was a really weird eye injury. So, you know, her having the doctor stoppage was certainly interesting. But, yeah, I can't blame her. Apparently, if they hadn't caught it, it could have been like a career-threatening type of deal.
Did you see this line for Pinheiro on KO? Because they don't have it on FanDuel yet, but DraftKings has it at plus 450.
Plus 450.
How is that, like, I'm confused. Is that not her most likely way to win? Is this line not going to flip? Come, like, are they not going to realize that maybe they posted this wrong?
Or I think they saw Loma. Loma landed 4 takedowns on Sam Hughes. I mean, Pinheiro is going to land some takedowns. It's just a question of, is she going to be hunting for the submission or the ground and pound when she's on top in round one? Because, like, round one is not going to be pretty. So it's like, that's why I think the inside the distance is like plus 215. You might as well just take that and meet in the middle on the line.
Yeah, because they have, you're right. And that's
what Pinheiro has 5 submission wins and 2 knockouts in her career and 1 DQ win. So, I mean, that's my thought.
Yeah, that's why, and that is why, because they have submission by plus 180. Sorry, it's not an egregious line.
No. Well, that's fair. I think we gave our best thoughts on that fight, right?
What was the line by finish? Plus.
By finish was plus 215.
Yeah, that would be the way to play Pinheiro. Otherwise, you know, maybe just stay.
Yeah, I mean, she has 7 finishes and 1 decision win in her career. I would much rather take the plus 215 on her winning inside the distance if I was going to take anything.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry. It was round one. It was round one was plus 215. I'm sorry. What's the winning method and the inside the distance to win by finish? Pinheiro is plus 110. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm confused about what you're talking about.
Pinheiro inside the distance is plus 110. I like Pinheiro round one at plus 215.
Oh, you said it was plus 2. You had it wrong, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Round one is the number I liked at plus 215. Because if a finish happens, it's going to come early.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that line didn't make any sense.
No, it didn't. It didn't. I'm sorry. So anyways, let's get moving along to our next fight, where the line is almost similarly as wide. We have Sean Soriano versus Shailan Nurdenbeka. This is a pretty straightforward striker versus grappler matchup, but Soriano also has a little bit of a background in wrestling himself. He was actually a state champion growing up, but in high school. But I think you see that more offensively than defensively when it comes to Soriano. So I think, can Nurdenbeka close the distance and avoid getting knocked out? Because, I mean, realistically, his defense isn't that great. But with the line at Soriano minus 275 and Nurdenbeka at plus 220, I would much rather look for a prop on this fight. Is that where you're leaning?
I mean, it's dog or pass for me. honestly. I mean, maybe the fight not to go the distance, but I assume that that line is going to be juiced. So, what do we have a line on that?
Let's see, pulling it up right now. So the fight to end inside the distance. -135.
That's interesting.
I feel like Nurdenbeka, you know, when he faced Koulibal in his last fight, he was giving up a lot of size. And here, you know, you can see he's giving up 1 inch in height and 1 inch in reach, but he was giving up 3 inches of height and 3 inches of reach to Josh Koulibal in his last fight. And Koulibal showed a lot of technical prowess in stuffing takedowns. I mean, when you look at the distance striking and any of the striking numbers, I mean, I know it's a really small sample size for Nurdenbeka given his one fight in the UFC, but Soriano, we know about his history as a coach at Sanford. So, you know, I mean, listen, when you're a kickboxing coach there and you've been working with Henry Hooft your whole career, it's not surprising to see that he's outclassing Nurdenbeka in almost every category when it comes to the striking. However, you can also see that when you get down to the wrestling, this is where Nurdenbeka is going to have the advantage. Now, his takedown percentage is absolute shit because he went to a 14 against Koulibal, but he showed impressive chain wrestling ability before he gassed out at the end of the first round.
And that seems to be the kryptonite of Sean Soriano. I mean, when you look back at his UFC career, right, giving up takedowns, takedown after takedown to Charles Rosa, to Chaz Skelly, to Kawajiri, not good. And that, you know, led to him being cut from the UFC essentially. And then, you know, he came back and against Christos Yagos on short notice, you know, I guess upper weight division, right? Yeah. upper weight division as well, you know, on short notice. So he does the UFC a favor. That's kind of how he gets his shot back in, other than I'm sure being well connected with Henry. And, you know, he shows he has a great first round. But that end of that first round is super sketchy. And then he loses the second. Like, he shows that his wrestling is still a problem. And, like, not only, like, a small problem, but, like, a liability. Like, he can't get up.
I feel like Soriano is way too willing to engage in the wrestling when he should be using whatever skills he has from his time wrestling in the past to be avoiding wrestling at all costs, like a Justin Gaethje type of deal.
Because you know what it is? That's exactly what it is. He has the wrestling base, so I would assume that he does feel some level of competency and confidence wrestling. It's not the wrestling that's his weakness. That's where I was mistaken. It's the jiu-jitsu that's clearly the weakness. He gives up the submissions. He gives up the cheap scramble and then puts himself in a bad position and is not as technically sharp in those jiu-jitsu realms, and he puts himself in trouble. So is Shaylin the type of guy that is good enough at jiu-jitsu to maybe make him pay for that? I'm not 100% sure, but what I do know is that I'm not paying -300 on Sean Soriano.
I will say it was a little bit sketchy how Nurdenbeka, I mean, like, he probably could have been knocked out by Koulibal if Koulibal just threw together a combination instead of just single shots against him. But he did, you know, show to be able to take a shot there. My concern is that Soriano's going to be throwing together combos. And if Nurdenbeka can't dictate it with the wrestling pace, then it could get uglier as the fight goes on. So, I mean, I totally get your point, though, because a guy like Sean Soriano, I mean, should he really ever be a -275? Nurdenbeka by submission is +1200 if you think Soriano loses once again his fifth fight in the UFC by submission. And Nurdenbeka does have 5 submission wins in his career, so it's not out of the question. But he likes to throw the heat, too, on the regional scene, 9 knockouts.
It's just not really a fight that I want to have too much exposure on in any which way. I don't really feel super confident about Sean Soriano, and even in a dog play where, you know, that's kind of a cool idea, like, it doesn't really work for me. Is that the same guy? How is that possible? Oh, it's not the same guy. He beat a different Alexi Olenek. What are the chances that someone is also named Alexi Olenek?
That's a great question. But Hey, anyway. Listen. Anyways, let's get on to our next fight here. We got Cody Durden versus Arichi Long. And yeah, I mean, Arichi Long coming off of a fight of the night performance against Jeff Molina. And Cody Durden, I mean, he put on quite a pace in the first round against Chris Gutierrez before giving up the last two. I mean, he got a 10-8 first round. So he gets a draw in his first appearance and then follows it up by getting flying triangle by Jimmy Flick. But he was winning the first few minutes of that fight.
Like 30 significant strikes to one or something. Like he was dominating that fight. And he just kind of gets caught in this, I don't know, just one of these polarizing moments in like MMA history, kind of with the flying triangle. It's just,
yeah,
it's just incredible stuff from Jimmy Flick. And he takes that 50 grand and I support of him.
Yeah, I really feel like this fight is bound to bring the heat as well. Durden loves bringing a pace. I am curious about how long he could keep said pace, especially coming off of ACL surgery. And then Arichi Long, we saw him kind of slow down a little, but it came on the heel of like a knockdown. So was it more that he got hurt or was it more that he gassed out? Because he still put on a fucking pace, keeping up with Jeff Molina for the most part. I mean, when you look at the significant strikes absorbed and faced, I mean, in one fight, 189 strikes absorbed, but he still landed 111 himself. That's impressive no matter what. I just am curious. Cody Durden seems to have legit grappling. So can Arichi Long defend himself? Because he has 3 submission losses in his career with only 1 win. And Durden's got 5 submission wins in his career with 2 submission losses. I could see Durden pulling the same type of game plan he pulled on Gutierrez.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Durden has showed himself to be shifty. He's a good striker. And like you said, he showed himself with the grappling, earning that 10-8 round, grappling with Chris Gutierrez, holding him down for that whole first round. And Gutierrez has showed himself to be an absolute fucking stud, man. The dark horse of that division. Really, really good. So when you look at what Durden did to him, I certainly, you know, in hindsight now, 2020, was impressed. And then you look at somebody like Arichi Lang, he's very technical. He does have the good footwork, but he walks forward a ton. And that can be a problem with somebody like Durden, who is going to have, right, he doesn't actually have the reach advantage there, which is kind of interesting because he just kind of fights like the longer guy. But when you look back at that Jeff Molina fight, that fight was about as even as possible with Jeff Molina until about 10 seconds left in round 2 when he gets absolutely clobbered with a jab when he throws a lazy kick because he kind of thought the round was ending. After he got clobbered with that jab, man, he was never the same. I mean, he was rocked. So he came out angry and mad and just he threw absolute reckless abandonment to the wind in that third round. And he just, I mean, he had no head movement to begin with, but the no head movement was now pronounced because of his Korean zombie-like just continuing to walk forward through the punishment. I just think that Cody Durden at this stage has, you know, looked at least relatively better against better competition. So I kind of feel like maybe it's a cheap way to look at it, but I feel like maybe Durden's due for a win.
I think, you know, Arichi Long definitely faced some, you know, issues in his first fight, not having his corner because there was some travel issues from coming over from the Shanghai PI. But I don't know that he's enough of like more than just an exciting fighter.
Yeah. I had no idea about the ACL surgery, by the way. So that was news to me. What did this line open up at? This is what I'm looking at right now. So it opened up as even. So that's what I thought. So I don't really like where it's at now. I don't love Cody Durden at -155. I like him better at -135, -5. Yeah, like
Yeah, I feel like Durden by submission at plus 650 would be the only way I would want to play him, because otherwise I would probably just stay away from this. But plus 650 for, you know, Richie Long has 3 submission losses and Durden has 5 submission wins. I think that there might be an angle there.
Yeah, I like that as our half greasy submission prop, because
there might be someone else coming up, but that's a greasy submission prop for me, I think.
I like
it. Yeah, but listen, I think that this is not a fight that I want to throw a lot of money on. I don't think you should either.
You're going to hear that a lot, this card, a little bit. I mean, not to be like a downer, but like this is a learning card. This is a building block type of card. We're going to have some bets out, don't get me wrong, and we're going to cash them. But this is a learning card where us handicappers, we get to sit back and we get to take a lot of notes, because you're going to see all of these fighters really, at least most of them, get another chance in the UFC. So a lot of these guys don't have a lot of experience. Terrence McKinney's of the world, even the Cody Durden's. You know what I mean? So this is definitely some good stuff here.
Yeah. So here we go. We're on to our next fight. And this is where we really start getting into some interesting matchups as far as a little more experience, a little bit more hype. Faricium, minus 115. Terrence McKinney, minus 105. That line's been fluctuating. It opened up dead even. McKinney went to a slight favorite, jumped back down to a plus 105 for a very short period. And then gets back to minus 105. So it seems like people can't really make a decision on where it should be. But, I mean, where I'm standing on this fight, you know, Faricium definitely holds the 3-inch height advantage, you know, 2-inch reach. I just think Terrence McKinney, coming off of that 7-second debut knockout, I don't know that a lot of people are familiar with how good of a wrestling background this guy has. He wrestled in high school. Michael Chiesa was his coach. He went off to Notre Dame, wrestled in college. Then he just got promoted to a jiu-jitsu purple belt very recently. In that Sean Woodson fight on Dana White Contender Series, I was super impressed with his technical ability and strength in the wrestling. Works a body triangle really well. But ultimately, Woodson shows enough defensively to be able to survive, and McKinney just completely fucking gasses out and shoots desperately and wildly. Similar thing going to happen here against Ziam?
It's hard not to worry. At the very least, it's hard not to worry that it can happen, because we haven't seen it. In his last 4 fights, the dude has fought for like 3 minutes. Or some shit, like, and he got choked out by Derek Minner, right? In 1 minute as well.
Yeah, but that happens in Derek Minner fights.
No, of course it does. Okay, so that's what I'm saying, though. That dude has strapped on gloves and made weight 5 times for his professional career, and then is like done fighting a minute later. Like, it's just been bizarre. I don't know how
long. And Faricium just continually keeps going to decision here in the UFC, huh?
So it's like one of those things, like either Faricium, like we all expect him to go the distance and he's going to get sparked in 15 seconds and it's going to be crazy, or he is going to go the distance.
I'm not sure that he has the defense once he's on the mat. It seemed like against Luigi Vendramini that Faricium did a good job, you know, leading with, you know, he had his knee cocked and ready to go. Anytime Luigi like kind of fainted changing levels, he threw a lot of front kicks. So I think that's all there and good and well, but McKinney definitely has a lot more power and size coming back. And I think, although not a lot of people can match Ziam's size in this division, McKinney's going to make up for it in strength and explosive ability. I don't think that he hurts him as much on the feet as much as he can get him to the cage and get to those clinch grappling exchanges and either take the back or get an explosive double leg. I do envision McKinney having a ton of success in the first round. It is a question mark of what happens when it gets past there. And Ziam has at least shown that he can survive. But listen, his round 3 against Vendramini could have very well been scored a 10-8. And that started on the feet where he nearly got knocked down. And then there was like a takedown scored, but I thought it was more like him being wobbled and hurt more so than like a technical takedown by Vendramini. But listen, Terrence McKinney's offensive wrestling, I just think is so much better. And give me the dog odds on that type of guy that, you know, in a smaller cage here, he's going to get the opportunity to work Zim backwards. And I think he'll get him to the mat in the first round.
That is interesting because I did think that you felt that Zim, that McKinney would have a stronger first round. When maybe I was wondering that if Zim would be able to use his pop and his strikes, especially in the first round, and use his length to maybe maintain that distance and not give up those takedowns. But he hasn't, like you said, he hasn't really fought anybody that's trying to mash his takedowns like Terrence McKinney. Well,
his last few fights have been in a bigger cage, Zim. This is his first one where he's going to be in the apex. When you went to one of his fights against Vendramini,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did.
And that was in a 30-foot octagon. This is now 25 feet, and you're talking about McKinney makes up all that explosion to make up the size of this advantage, you know? And then he's got the wrestling ability.
You know what? That's actually a really, really, really interesting point. All three of his UFC fights, including his debut against Don Madge, Khabib Poirier, has all been in a big octagon. So this is his first in a small octagon, and his style needs the big octagon. Give me Terrence McKinney here.
Yeah, -105, and at the weigh-ins, listen, face off all that, it might slide the other way because of the size difference. So hang tight. I'm going McKinney.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, on to our next fight. We got Loma Lubunmi versus Lupi Godinez. This one is gonna be.
We got to talk about Lupi for a second. We got to talk about Lupi for a second, right?
Go ahead.
She's breaking the modern UFC record, right? Is it 42 days? Three fights in 42 days. She beats Cerrone. She beats Angela Hill. She beats Chimaev, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. She fought October 9th, then fought October 16th, and now returns back November 20th. I mean, it's just. I can't even it's just something that we don't really get to appreciate enough because, you know, we see hockey games every day or we see basketball games every other day, or we see fighters make these turnarounds, but for this chick to come back around within a month and fight again for a third time, hats off to her. She getting paid. so that's awesome.
Yeah, I really think, man, this fight, it opened up with Loma at +130 and Lupi at -150. I thought this line might close up a little bit more, but I mean, Loma's at +140 now. I remain curious, you know, because Lupi, she did go up and fight a much bigger fighter, and she has shown persistence and a good gas tank and overall good wrestling ability. But I mean, listen, even in Lupi's last fight, I thought, you know, in the early stages where she gets the fight down to the ground, you know, she lets her get back up. The control isn't overall great aside from like clinching cage control overall. And while she's opportunistic in getting that arm bar, it looked to be more of a mistake from her opponent. And Loma has shown to be super strong. Her takedown defense has improved leaps and bounds. She's shooting immediately for underhooks. And she's low to the ground, got a good center of gravity. And then she starts digging those knees into the body in the clinch. I mean, her clinch work is just way above any other opponent. And coming from a Muay Thai background, that's really not too surprising, huh?
No, definitely not. One of the reasons why I would be interested in playing her as a dog, I'm not fully sure where I'm at yet, but one of the reasons I definitely like her as a dog is that Muay Thai clinch, is the punishment that she brings up close. She's scrappy. She's not just going to sit there and just be a dead fish on the ground if Lupi's on top of her. She's going to shrimp and she's going to scrap and she's going to try to fight her way back up. One of the things that was really concerning for
Guru just froze up there for a second.
56 for UFC.
Let's see. Guru is removed. He's going to have to pop back in here. Sorry about the delay, guys. But ultimately, I was really looking towards Loma Luke Boonmi as a plus 140 underdog. I feel like, if anything, it should be an even line. And my ultimate feel is, I would definitely want to take Loma in this spot, money line. I know Guru is about to get into a point here. He's joining us back in.
Sorry, everybody. That's never happened to me before.
Good. Well, you're back.
Yes. So one of the things, I don't know where I cut out, but one of the things that was really interesting to me, and one of the red flags, at least, that I saw with when I was looking at Luma, is that in her four UFC fights, her four UFC opponents, none of them have landed more than two takedowns per minute. That would be really impressive. More than two takedowns per 15 minutes. Right, so that's not really the style of anybody that she's faced. When she's facing Loopy here, Loopy lands over four takedowns per 15 minutes. It is a major, major increase in grappling pressure and grappling skill. Because let's just simply dissect grapplers. Forget the fighting aspect. Let's just talk about grapplers, who she's fought. Sam Hughes. We're going to discuss her later. I mean, we discussed her earlier. Sorry, but she's showed herself to be a punching bag, and Luma was one of those people that treated her like a punching bag. Jinyu Fry, a striker who is a very inaccurate striker, who then also tried to grapple with her and actually was able to take her down at one point. Angela Hill, who we know is a decent-ish striker, who is a terrible grappler, has a takedown on Loma. And then Alexandra Albu, who is no longer in the UFC and probably more well-known for her like OnlyFans than for her UFC career, and also has a takedown on Loma. So while I'm extremely concerned with Loopy's weight cutting again, just taking damage again, why she's taking this fight, it's all a little weird to me in general. But if you're telling me not weight cut drained, fully ready to rock, I mean, just and sharp in terms of a game plan, yeah, I think it could be a real problem for Loma, because I'm not sure, with the striking, yeah, she could piece her up for that first round, but like the pressure's gonna keep coming. Can she continue to stem the tide, or will eventually she get taken down?
That's a great question. I do think that Loma is extremely strong in those situations and has shown improvement in her time. She now trains out of with the Hickman brothers out of their gym, and they are. Big time. I believe Jamie Hickman is the big time wrestling coach. I really think that she has shown a ton of improvement, and those knees, when you get in that clinch situation, might deter Loopy from even wanting to get there. And I do think Loopy does have some pretty good explosive striking. It's just, you wouldn't want to get in a striking battle with someone that outstruck Angela Hill. I mean, Loma's outstruck every opponent she's faced from distance, and she's outstruck them in the clinch. It's all about
like Loma as a person, as a fighter. She's really exciting, especially for the division. And really, when she's not even like truly like a strawweight, right? Shouldn't she be more of an atomweight?
Yeah, I would agree.
So, yeah, she fought atomweight in Invicta, so that was her last Invicta fight, and then she comes to the UFC where atomweight is not a thing. And obviously steps up. So I love Luma personally. I itch to play her. I look to play her. I look to fade Loopy, but we'll see. Stay tuned to our Bet MMA guys. Like, you know, not to be a downer, not to come to a full conclusion there, but we don't want to, you know, sell you a bill of goods that's no good either. So stick to our Bet MMA page. stick to those link trees. Check our Twitters. Keep posted with us because we will update.
Yeah, I think so. For this next fight, I'll be pretty straightforward about it. We got Rafa Garcia versus Natan Levy. This is one of those ones where I didn't fully get to as much as I would like to on it, as much as these other fights. And part of the reason is that Natan Levy in his contender series fight.
Tyler, TB, you have the wrong stats up.
Exactly. I didn't even have any stats for Natan Levy or anything like that. So that's my ultimate point is, like, realistically, I don't have a great play on this fight. I really don't. And Natan Levy.
Yeah,
Rafa Garcia, Natan Levy. I mean, Natan Levy opened as a -135 and gets bet down to a +105. That catches my eye because for some reason the bookmakers think that this contender series guy, you know, should be favored here. Rafa Garcia maybe had a bad look in his first two times, but is this going to be a step down for him? I mean, I just can't safely say at this point where I'm at in this week of tape study. This fight, I just didn't get to as much as I would have liked to from an honest standpoint.
I certainly understand that, and I'd have to agree. I mean, a lot of Natan Levy, you get a little bit of the Dana White Contender Series, and you're watching a lot of LFA fights, and oh my god, my shit crashed here, my internet's still being janky, and then with Rafa Garcia, I mean, he had that impressive, quote unquote, impressive short notice debut against Nasrat, right, Hackparast, but. You know, so we're like, oh, maybe we'll look, maybe he's good, you know. And then he comes out versus Grootsmacher and just shits the bed, right? And had a very unimpressive performance. Maybe thought he was getting the finish in that first round, and where he looked as though maybe he had cardio for days, so to speak, against Nasrat in that loss. He kind of gasses out after that first round against Grootsmacher and then loses that fight. And as I think he might have been the biggest favorite on the card that night. So just it's really like I said earlier, this is just one of those cards where you're going to sit back and learn something. Rafa Garcia and Natan Levy will get another UFC fight each for sure. So this is a good spot to really learn about them. Just on a crazy card like this, I want to lean to the dog, which would be Natan Levy, because I feel like maybe the fight should just be more of a coin flip pick 'em. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's really it. And so let's get right along to this next fight where I promise I did a lot more tape and I have a lot stronger feelings.
And you have the stats up, so sorry about that.
Yes, exactly. No problem. So here we are. We got Pat Sabatini and we got Tucker Lutz. And if you guys know anything about me on Chronic Combat here, it's that I love fading me some Dana White Contender Series guys. Tucker Lutz, I'm pretty sure I took Kevin Aguilar against him, so I do kind of hate myself for that. But ultimately, so Lutz here, they match up well as far as height. Lutz is going to have a 2-inch reach advantage. He's 12-1 in his career, 1-0 in the UFC. The things that are standing out to me, Pat Sabatini with the 11 submission wins, where Tucker Lutz has 2. Lutz has 6 KOs, whereas Sabatini has 1. His KO loss was he fractured his arm. AI got dislocated. So I wouldn't read too much into that. But what I would read into is in his debut against Jamal Emmers, this guy goes out there, not in his debut, in his second fight. Pat Sabatini gets like hurt, knocked down, gets fully mounted immediately. I mean, that's a little bit of an issue, right?
I wouldn't say that the mount was the full issue. He got
I'm saying. He was that badly hurt.
No, yes, that was more my point, is that he was so badly rocked by Jamal Emmers to start that fight. That he's able to really crash forward quickly, gets in the mount, and then Emmers just kind of starts playing the submission game with him, because that is where Emmers' bread and butter is, buttered, so to speak. But Sabatini is just an absolute savage on the ground, and just a different level than Emmers. And he showed it even with a concussion. He snapped his leg. And
He had a big-time debut against Tristan Connolly, right?
Well, so yeah, he had a great performance against Tristan in those first two rounds and maybe kind of slowed down and dropped that third round against Connolly for sure. Tucker Lutz has showed some, you know, he's really patient. He's definitely like more technical than Sabatini. And he really prefers that kind of technical fight, doesn't prefer to be in some sort of ugly, sloppy fight. I saw some solid left hooks from Lutz, and he had some really good timing on the takedowns, with like limited telegraph, which was pretty cool. But all roads for Tucker Lutz, at least that I saw, on the limited tape that I did see with Aguilera and his two Dana White Contender Series fights, for him it seems like all roads led back to the grappling, whether it was clinching against the cage or shooting for the takedown or back to the ground. Like, as good as he, as decent as he was, or capable as he was on the feet, like, all roads led back home. Everything eventually was to set up the grind. And I don't think the grind's an option here.
I just think
Sabatini's too much of a wizard. Like, it's a problem. So is Lutz gonna have the fight IQ, the wherewithal to, like, I don't know, pepper him up for like 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes, and then take him down for a little bit, like, and then do that, and then rinse and repeat that for two, three rounds? Like, I don't know. So, I mean, I have made money on Sabatini. I really enjoyed Sabatini. I loved his regional tape coming in. I've been excited watching him. I was almost kind of looking to fade him in a spot like this because, again, coming off two wins and two decently popular wins, but, like, I don't know, -130, and like I said, all roads lead back to his wheelhouse. Like, it's kind of hard not to take him here, and maybe it's really Lutz that's due for a loss. He fought Aguilera, who lost his final fight. I mean, Lutz put the final nail in his UFC coffin, so to speak.
Yeah, the thing I come back to about Sabatini is I really just think I agree with you. He is next level on the ground. If there's one thing I learned last week from Daun Jung is that if you feel good about a fighter that's really not that far off from the plus money range, just play it straight, because then you're going to see someone get – and because I'm sitting here like, oh, how can I get Sabatini to plus money? Do I want to go decision? Do I want to play Sabatini and over 1.5? Really, it's Sabatini -130. Just be happy you're getting it that close to plus 100 and just play it. That's it. If you need to put 1.3 units to win one, do it that way. Like, but please just don't go betting Sabatini and the over or Sabatini by decision and then coming back crying when, you know, if he gets a submission because Lutz, you know, fucked around and found out.
And by the way, coming back crying, he's not talking about any of you guys in the audience. It's really just me that is doing
it. Oh, I'm talking about Guru. Let me tell you guys something. talk about when we lose some bets. Anyhow, but yeah, it's ultimately Pat Sabatini money line is where I'm going to go. Let's not get too cute.
Talk about not getting too cute. This next fight is one that I would not want to get too cute with at all. Maybe if you have to parlay something, anything, because this is not the card to parlay things, maybe. Is this our fight? I think this is our guy. He seems to be everybody's guy, which is now the problem.
That's,
right?
Yeah, now that makes me concerned.
Right, because what's holding the line in play? I love when...
all
right,
so let's talk about who it is and what the line is. We got Adrian Yanez versus Davy Grant. And yeah, I mean, listen, this line is ballooned. Adrian Yanez opened up as a -265. We're looking at a -320 now. Davy Grant is +250. This is prime Davy Grant underdog. No, you know, do what he does type of deal. But Davy Grant doesn't really have a size advantage here. He's 1 inch taller, but he's giving up 1 inch in reach. Adrian Yanez actually has a more fulfilled MMA record at 14-3 than Davy Grant has at 11-5. Adrian Yanez has knocked out nine opponents and never been knocked out, whereas Davy Grant's only knocked out three guys. And yeah, I mean, he hasn't ever been knocked out, but how many times have we seen Davy Grant get knocked down?
A lot.
It is really interesting, though, because when you look at some of these stats as we go down, I mean, the accuracy for Giannis is definitely a little bit lower than we're seeing for Davy Grant here, and even from distance. And I think the thing that we're seeing is that Giannis puts out a lot more volume. And Davy Grant seems to have some combos that he works with going to the body and the head. But, yeah, I mean, as far as a well-rounded game, he's been there offensively grappling. He's been there defensively grappling. I can totally understand why you might want to be playing Davy Grant against Adrian Yanez. I've tried to fade Adrian Yanez almost every single time in the UFC. Ultimately, I just come back to I've seen Davy Grant get knocked down by Martin Day. I've seen Davy Grant get knocked down by Jonathan Martinez. You're telling me that Davy Grant's not going to get knocked down by Adrian Yanez and knocked out? Eventually, maybe. Yeah.
I do. I really do think that this is the Giannis show. I think they really like him. I think this is another good matchup. You watch Davy Grant. He throws these kind of ridiculous looping punches. And, you know, it got him the knockout versus Jonathan Martinez, so kudos. But when you're fighting a technical boxer like Adrian Giannis, he's going to punish you for any sort of wasted movement. And that's like almost Davy Grant's like MO. So I like Giannis in those first round or two, man. I think he might get it done again. And
so this is where Guru gets mad at me.
Yeah, tell me.
So we look at Davy Grant's record. He actually has 8 submission wins, but what's he got? 4 submission losses out of his 5 losses. Adrian Yanez does have 2 submission wins, and he does have a jiu-jitsu black belt.
Uh-oh.
And in a very short clip I saw of the Miles Johns fight in the 5th round against Yanez, we're seeing Yanez go for like a little front choke series. And, you know, Miles Johns is able to scramble out, very high-level wrestler. The point being, we've seen Davy Grant knocked down a bunch of times, but never knocked out. But we've seen him submitted a whole fuck ton, right? I mean, Adrian Yanez by submission at plus 1,000, as far as like he's plus 100 for a knockout. And like that is like the. Okay, so.
Even less. Is that even plus money?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know that inside the distance for Adrian Yanez is plus money, but. I mean, I would want to say, like, you know, fade the narrative. Oh, you know, maybe this goes to decision, but I've seen Davy Grant hurt way too many times. What if Yanez uses that opportunity to jump and, like, scoop the neck and go for the rear naked choke? That's where it's, like, really sketchy. So it's like, you know, maybe you don't want to go too crazy on that. But say, so to win by finish, Adrian Yanez, to answer your question, we got
minus 115. So, and then listen, the one concern that you'd have about Adrian Yanez would be the grappling, right? But then you look at Davy Grant's numbers, and sure, you see an average of 2 takedowns for 15 minutes at a 46% accuracy. But you put some credence into those stats, and yeah, he had 2 takedowns of 4 versus Martin Day, whatever. He had, and then this is the big one, he had 6 takedowns versus Grigory Popov, 6 of 9. Like, yeah, you're a real wrestler now, pal. Grigory Popov and Martin.
Yeah, it's all about matchups and reading into the stats because, yeah, on paper, you know, that looks great. 46% accuracy and 2 takedowns. Wow, that's elite. But then you look at the names that he did it against, and Yanez knows how to maintain his distance even in the small cage. That's why I stupidly picked Gustavo Lopez. Lopez couldn't close the fucking distance. He ended up sleeping for it.
Yeah.
Lesson learned, huh?
Yeah. I've been on Yanez. I'm on that Yanez train. I'm sure you'll be wearing your Yanez shirt this weekend.
That's right.
We got Adrian Yanez here. Let's roll.
Amen. Let's get on to our next fight. So we got name change alert. It's Joanne Wood versus Tyla Santos. We dropped the Calder. We're only Joanne Wood now. She married a head coach at Syndicate MMA. So Joanne Wood, 35 years old, Santos, 28. I mean, Joanne Wood giving up 3 inches of reach here. That's tough. But Tyla Santos at minus 380. and Joanne Wood at plus 290.
Yeah, really?
I can't bet against Santos here, right?
I don't know. I hate to say that. I don't know. This fight is a full pass for me. And if it's not, it's dogger pass because Santos should be, has showed herself to be way more aggressive, has showed herself to be brute on the ground and savage striking. And we watched Joanne Wood in her last fight get controlled, and a little bit bullied by, Lauren Murphy. So you kind of wonder if that could happen again. You know, I rewatched that fight, and that fight was every bit of a split decision with Lauren Murphy, right? I mean, I was there live, and then I rewatched it a couple times for Lauren Murphy versus Shevchenko, and then Wood here. Man, I don't really know who won the fight, man. It was damn close. So if she put on that, I mean, the decent of a performance, right? So maybe she's decent. Then you look back at the fight before that. What's her actual wins? She beat Jessica freaking I, man. Jessica I. It's not really worth much. Who fought last week? Whose really only good win was Jessica I? Do you remember?
Calvia.
Yeah, Calvillo. Thank you. Exactly. So we're wondering why Andrea Lee is smashing Calvillo and how we missed the fact that that chick can't strike. And it's like, oh, well, she crashed her way into the top five by beating a Jessica freaking I, man. Like that, you start to think that somebody actually had a decent performance or is a good fighter, and then you realize who they beat. She's beat Jessica I, a split decision versus Andrea Lee before that she's made this transformation. Beaten Ariana Lipsky and Faria, who's no longer in the UFC, a loss to Calvillo, a loss to Chikagian, a loss to Andrade, a loss to Jennifer Maya. I don't know, man. Santos seems to be on the up and up. I get why she's favored. I just, as you discussed in way less words, how do we pay minus 350 for Santos here?
Yeah, I ultimately did not like the fact that Tyler Santos got outlanded from distance by Molly McCann, got cut open in the first round by Molly McCann. And I do think Joanne Wood is much tougher than, most of the opponents besides Molly McCann, I'd say that Santos has fought. I just don't trust Joanne Wood to stuff the takedowns when it gets there. I don't.
Can we just give Joanne Wood some credit here? Even if Santos mops the floor with her, Wood is a step up from Roxanne Modafferi and Jillian Robertson and Molly McCann.
Oh, definitely. Ultimately, I mean, she has three submission losses and Santos has two submission wins. Santos by submission plus 700. With all the top control and pressure and everything and the physicality, if you think that there would be a finish, that would be it. But I don't want to touch anything when it comes to this fight.
Listen, and Appy, I don't know. Listen, she's got so many knockouts too, Santos. Santos has 10 knockout wins. So,
you know. Yeah, I think it came more from size and physicality rather than technical ability. And I think Joanne Wood will be able to survive on her feet based off the technical ability. It comes to the ground and pound or submission ability.
She didn't finish Molly McCann. She didn't finish Roxanne Modafferi, who was obviously one leg out the door, now retiring. She's not finishing Joanne Wood here unless Joanne Wood had some sort of bad weight cut or something mentally is not going right. She's not going to finish Wood. Honestly, I don't know what the line is, but maybe this fight to go the distance is the fucking play. I'm sure it's juiced up to all hell.
Yeah, maybe just the fight to be a split decision also because Joanne Wood always finds a way to be a split decision.
I like that too. Minus 280 to go the distance is not the worst one ever, but it's pretty juiced.
Yeah, I feel like that's where a cut stoppage comes into play and you end up fucking pissing yourself. I hate playing ones like that now. Anything like that's in like that above like a minus 200 range when it comes to like overs or unders. Because sometimes it just feels like we've been getting burned on those.
Split a majority decision plus 330 on FanDuel. So, I mean, DraftKings.
Hmm. So
moving right along.
Let's get on to our next fight here. We got Kyung Ho Kang versus Ronnie Yahya.
A rebook. This fight was how long ago?
At least a couple months. I mean, Ronnie Yahya got COVID, so that's one factor.
July 31st. This was supposed to be on the Hall Strickland card.
Wow. Yeah, so I mean, they pushed this far back, and that makes you really think about how bad of COVID did Ronnie Yahya have, or was this, you know, travel restrictions, stuff like that? I mean, listen, Kyung Ho Kang, 3 years younger. Ronnie Yahya is 36 years old, and in such a small weight class, that's where you really see some of the explosion and some of the downsides start coming in. I mean, Kong's got a 3-inch height advantage. He's got a 6-inch reach advantage, and I think he's got a huge advantage in the striking ability on the feet. Then when this fight hits the mat, I mean, Ronnie Yahya, 21-1 as far as submissions go alone, and Kyung Ho Kang, 11-1. I don't think either guy is going to submit the other. I do think that we could see some sketchy, you know, top control periods and stuff like that. But I think that's going to come from the Kang side. I think the size differential is just too much. I don't think Yahya's beaten anyone worth a damn in the UFC. And when you start looking into the sample size, I mean, Kang from distance, I mean, almost 4% more accurate, and he lands, you know, a little bit more per minute. The clinch, he does a lot more in the clinch. The one thing that you might say is, you know, ground strikes per takedown. Kang is doing a lot more work than Yahya, and a lot of those strikes aren't significant that aren't even counted towards this. So as far as, like, everything goes here, I just think that Kang provides it all. And I'm sitting here curious, why is the line only -115 and Yahya -105?
Honestly, because when I first looked at this fight, I remember being so sketched out because, oh my God, Kang is so hittable. And Yahya, he throws all these power strikes. He throws everything into it. And then, you know, we know Yahya's game. He throws everything into his strikes. He crashes in to try to get to the clinch because he just wants to literally fall on top of you, drag you down to the mat any way, shape, or form possible and try to submit you. But what we've found by Kang is that Kang's defensive grappling is at least decent enough that he's not necessarily going to get submitted on the ground. No problem. And the striking that seemed to have caused him a problem is not these one-off power shots. It's these really quick technical combo strikers, somebody like Ricardo Ramos, somebody like that, that really had caused him more trouble. I would say it's kind of difficult to say that, like, Yahya hasn't beat anybody worth a damn, but somehow Kang has. Brandon Davis and Gino Canetti.
Yeah, but think about like, I'm talking about based on the popularity of their names and how they're talked about. I feel like Ronnie Yahya gets a lot more shine than Kyung Ho Kang does. I mean,
I think that's just because of how long he's been in the UFC. I mean, Ronnie Yahya fought Chad Mendes in 2011. He fought Mizugaki in 2010, Benavidez in 2009. I mean, he beat Eddie Weiland in the WEC in 2009. I mean, that's why he's talked about the way he's talked about.
Yeah, I just think when you look at, like, there's, like, at least statistically and how they've fared against the people that they have faced, I don't see why, given their physical attributes, why Yahya is expected to put on a performance against Kang here. Maybe I eat my words going forward, but I mean, Kang at damn near even money. Give me that all day.
Well, what's our favorite prop looking like? Let's see here. There's a couple props that I actually maybe now would think about now that we're kind of starting to flesh this one out a little bit. What if we did? Maybe you don't like it. What about Kang just by decision only? Kang decision only. Oh, that's interesting. Is -175. So they figure the same thing that I do.
Yeah, well, because you save yourself the money if he ends up getting finished by Yahya.
Yeah.
I think I'm realistically Kang and just
over
Kang.
One and a half.
I'm learning my no, just Kang. I'm learning my lessons, bro. He's -115. Just play him. Just do it.
But over one and a half is +130.
And then you're sitting there going, why the fuck did I play over 1.5 when he's facing when he a 36-year-old? Round, yeah. And he hits him with a front kick because Kong's kickboxing is fucking solid. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if this fight stays standing because they're both such good grapplers and Kong just fucking puts the pace on him and hurts him. That would not be a shock to me. You've seen Yaya lose by knockout twice and never get a knockout win. Kong's has 2 knockouts on his record. It's not that far-fetched.
2 is not very many.
Yeah, but that doesn't, like, with the 11 submission wins, he still has 2 knockouts.
Dude, I mean, Kang is very much a, he's got 11 submission wins, 4 decision wins, and 2 by knockout. So,
listen, maybe I'm just scared of the Kennedy Zichekwu versus Down Jung result because I'm still sitting here beating myself up that I didn't just take Down Jung straight up. You know,
I mean, yeah,
so but I'm gonna learn my lesson. Take Kyung Ho Kong -130 straight up. Take Pat Sabatini, or I'm -115. Take Pat Sabatini -130 straight up. You know, when it's those close opportunities, maybe just play them straight up and then take your winnings.
I agree.
That was at least the way I saw it. So now we get
especially when you have lines that close. It's different when it's -190, -245. You know, if we're playing -115, -140, man, like you're right. Just you like your side, just play it.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, very attractive to get the plus money, make a little bit more, but sometimes you just gotta
take what you can. Nothing is more attractive than a fucking green ticket. And more money than what you started with.
Speak the truth right there. That's guru for you.
Let's
get to our Michael Chiesa, Sean Brady. Real quick intro for you guys. Chiesa's got a 3-inch height, 3-inch reach advantage. And Sean Brady in his UFC debut weighed in at 167. Whereas Chiesa was killing himself to make 155, is still killing himself to make 170. And has talked about fighting at 185 in the future. Michael Chiesa, 16 fights in the UFC, Sean Brady, 4. And let's just say the talent level that Chiesa's faced has been way higher than Sean Brady. I'm sitting here scratching my head just based off of overall wrestling ability and experience. Michael Chiesa, +140. Talk to me, guru. What am I seeing here?
I mean, I know what I'm seeing. I'm seeing Michael Chiesa as a three-peat dog of the day. That's what I'm seeing. Because the one way Chiesa loses this fight is the same way he always loses this fight, mentally. Is he up for this fight? Is he motivated? Does he see himself actually as a threat to Usman in the title? Like, can he mentally... Is he mentally ready to climb that mountain? Does he really want to? Because if not, I know for a fucking fact Sean Brady's hungry. That I know for a fact. But if the mental stuff is aside, when I saw Michael Chiesa's mistake versus Luque, I'm like, he got overexcited. He's fighting Vicente Luque. He thinks he's got a chance to get a submission. He got overexcited and messed it up. And I that's what I thought. I'm far from any fucking MMA fighter.
He also thought he had a shot for a title chance.
That's what I thought I saw. And to hear him say in an interview, I guess today, saying exactly that he got overzealous and got really too excited and was just so disappointed. Shout out our boy Alex for asking that question. That solidifies like where his head's at. I mean, he wants to come out and prove that he's a top dog here, right? That's what this is. They got the young bucks nipping at his heels. Go out there, put a fucking stamp on it for 3 rounds. That this young lion that people think is so good, and show yourself who you are because he can get another sick top fight. I mean, he could get the winner of Woodley and Bilal Wonderboy and Bilal, for example. Like, there are plenty of big fights for him to go get. So he just has to come out and do it.
Chiesa has proven before that he can use control over submission, and he said it himself. He went for submission before he ever had control against Luque. He had Luque controlled. He lost it in a scramble and then shoots immediately back for a single leg and just ends up in, oh, wait, Luque? Oh, he's only the best guy with the darst choke in the entire UFC. Oh, I wonder why that would be a problem. Yeah, so, I mean, Chiesa at first, I was like, oh, man, it looks like he's going to survive the position. Nah, it didn't happen. He was way too overexcited, as you said. This is a step down as far as he's not fighting on a pay-per-view card, and two, he's fighting Sean Brady as opposed to Vicente Luque, who's an absolute fucking killer. I think Sean Brady does bring a lot of attributes to the table. He is extremely proficient in the stand-up. I do think his lead check left hook is very potent. I do think that he has explosive takedowns, but I do think a lot of his fights, he's been relying on his athleticism and his strength advantage, and he's not going to be stronger than Chiesa in the grappling here. I just don't see that. And
he's not going to be stronger than Chiesa in the grappling. Yeah, he's not going to be bigger than Chiesa in the grappling. He's not more well-versed than Chiesa in the grappling.
His signature move is a guillotine.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, Vicente Luque's favorite move, his signature move is the fucking darce. I mean, he threw himself right into the jaws of the alligator, man. And the alligator's thing is his jaw.
You're right.
And let's just be real. I pointed this out earlier in the week. Sean Brady's last fight is Jake fucking Matthews, man. Jake Matthews. Where is Jake Matthews in relation to Michael Chiesa? One step, two step, three step, four. What, like, what the fuck? It's kind of crazy. And you look at, yeah, Sean Brady got that sub. Great. You know how long it took him to get it? He needed 8 minutes of control time. 8 minutes of wearing.
This is not just dog of the day. This is the play of the day, folks. I'm sorry. Just, there's nothing else to say here. This is it. This is the spot.
Has to be.
Plus 140.
Gotta die. And listen, you gotta be willing to die on this hill, because if not, if he loses, Sean Brady subs him, that's another mental mistake. And Michael Chiesa's career will be written off that same night. He will never be taken seriously as a top 10 contender again. That will be that. Even if I feel very confident saying that he goes out there and gets submitted. It is a really poor look. Maybe a split decision loss, maybe he can overcome that one, but I think that he's the more technical fighter, the stronger fighter, the bigger fighter. Vicente Luque needed 10 seconds of top control to get the sub. Brady needed 8 minutes versus Jake Matthews, and he's not gonna have 8 minutes time versus Michael Chiesa.
Wow, that's a good point. So shall we, as we move on from our dog of the day / play of the day, we go to our main event. Kaitlyn Vieira, minus 120. Misha Tate, plus 100. I don't know that I love anything here.
What does she think she is? Augusto Sakai or Carlos, your boy Felipe? Who gets a main event off a loss and a missing weight loss? What is happening?
So let me say this is that, yeah.
I was going to say, do you know what's happening? What's happening is that this is all about Misha Tate. This is the Misha Tate show.
But I can't help but feel like sometimes when the UFC tries to do that and they have all these ideas and Misha Tate's talking about how she could get Nunes and the right opportunity, you're still fighting Kaitlyn Vieira, and Kaitlyn Vieira has a 2-inch height advantage and a 3-inch reach advantage. And I mean, until recently, she was undefeated in MMA. She gets knocked the fuck out by Irene Aldana because she comes forward a little bit too much as she gets exciting, hurting Aldana herself. And then, yeah, we talk about that last fight. She won 14 minutes and 50 seconds of that fight and then lost that. I'm sorry. She was 10 seconds away from winning 2 rounds of that fight. And that shit got turned around, and she got busted open with some elbows in the last 10 seconds against Yana Kunitskaya. And that says a lot.
Listen, you know what you sound like? You sound like the football player that blames the loss on missing the kick. There were plenty of plays before that caused the loss. Yeah, the way that the last 15 seconds of that round ended, that third round, for sure Yana put a stamp on it. Vieira did not strike. She did not strike. She had plenty of opportunities to have possibly still won the fight having that bad last 15 seconds. She did not strike.
and it was a fucking problem. And I really think it had everything to do with the weight cut because she just looked terrible. But when you look back at that Irina Adani knockout, she looked great to start off the fight and then got caught. But like we've seen Irina Adani, everybody took her versus Holly Holm, and that was a bad pick, man.
So not for us because we were all over Holly. But you know, you saw somebody get exposed a little bit there, man. So I don't really know exactly how good Irina Aldana is. I just think that if you're gonna gas out versus Yana Kuniskaya, Misha Tate is like the better version of Yana Kuniskaya.
Well, Vieira also missed weight badly and looked terrible at weigh-ins and face-offs that week.
She only missed
absolutely pounds, miserable.
Yeah, she did look terrible.
Yeah, no, but she looked miserable. And then she still wins all the grappling exchanges with control. And then she hunts for a submission at the last second, which was so fucking stupid. So my question, I think Vieira is the more technical stand-up striker, no?
I don't, technical is such an interesting word to use. I just think that Ketlin is the more powerful stand-up striker. I think she's also more comfortable
on her feet.
Because she wings those punches. She throws everything in them.
Right, but then I think her wrestling and her wrestling defense are also a lot to contend with for Misha Tate. I mean, she stuffed 13 out of 14 takedowns in the UFC, Ketlin Vieira. She's landed 48% of her own takedowns.
You have to look at against who.
I don't know that there's, but I'm not sure that there's a crutch to lean on here. I mean, like, listen, Sajara Eubanks, we could say whatever we want, but she's a great grappler. So I do think that Vieira being able to go back and land those takedowns, which, you know, in parts where, you know, it gets sketchier in the stand-up and stuff like that, like, she's able to land those two takedowns when she needs them. She's able to land two takedowns on Katsanganu. She's able to land a takedown and get two submission attempts and end up with an arm triangle win over Sarah McMahon. She gets a takedown on Ashley Evans-Smith, and, yeah, she lands four on Kelly Faschel. So take that for what you will. But consistently, Ketlin Vieira has proven that she can land takedowns, and the only person she's ever given up a takedown to was Sarah McMahon. So is Misha Tate as strong or as technical with her wrestling as Sarah McMahon if she wants to go that route? And if not, can she win a stand-up battle against Ketlin Vieira? I'm not sure either question gets answered with a yes, and I think Misha Tate actually might lose here to the younger fighter.
I really don't think so. They actually both fought Sarah McMahon, which is very interesting, and obviously it came a while ago. You know, that you saw,
I see a decision win for Vieira, the -120 favorite.
Wow. That's a brazen pick.
Wow. Hold on a second. Because I just got a little sloppy there. We're talking a 5-round fight.
Yeah. What do you mean? So,
but honestly, but at the same time, with the Norma Dumont and Aspen Ladd fight, I'm sitting there going blah blah blah, and like, listen, they sit into a pace and they settle in. I think we can see a lot of grappling and a lot of pushing up against the cage in this fight, and I think Vieira is the bigger, stronger fighter.
I will very much like to see how they face off and how they look. It's really hard to trust somebody like Ketlin Vieira after her last. Honestly, it's hard to trust both of these entities. Truly.
Yeah. I would love to see how Vieira looks on the scale.
Misha Tate put out Marion Renault for punched her ticket out of the UFC. Good job. And we saw last time we saw Ketlin, like we discussed, she looked terrible versus Yana. So we need, this is a fight. If you even touch this fight before weigh-in day, you are a sicko. You have to watch these girls face off and see how they look. And my prop that I lean to is Eileen Tate round 4-5 decision. I think that she can weather the storm. I don't see her getting out wrestled or out grappled for a majority of this fight. So I think Miesha Tate eventually can pull away, even if she drops an early round and she can get a late finish or just a decision, you know, 49-46 or 48-47 type of shit.
All right, guys. Well, keep an eye out for our Chronic Combat page on Bet MMA Tips for our final bets. We have a little divergence in the main event this week after having a little divergence in the co-main. I will say I got Marcos Rogério de Lima last week. Let's see if you can get Miesha Tate over me this week. Chronic Combat listeners.
That knockout was fucking brutal. Ben Rothwell did not come out to fight.
Herb fucking Dean, man. How about Herb Dean?
Herb Dean, I mean, makes me miss Dan Hardy because he was right. Herb Dean is just hasn't been as focused in the octagon. But everybody, listen, thank you so much for tuning in. With no podcast next week because there are no fights. So I want to wish you and your families a very, very happy Thanksgiving and Boxing Day to any Canadian listeners. And happy Indigenous People Day as well. Just take the time to, cherish your loved ones and give thanks for just, you know, waking up for another day and maybe watching some more fights. So thanks for spending your time with us, guys. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.